Good morning, everyone. Happy May Day, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or, well, we don't have our minister, Jane Espenson, anymore, so I can't tell you that. We're searching for a new minister. Today, we have a member of the wider community, and it's the Reverend Kalen Freestead, I think I pronounced your name right, who will be presenting Universalism, Past, Present, and Powerful, and his wife is here as well. Reverend Freestead has copies of his book, Destined for Salvation, on sale on the lobby, along with CD copies of today's sermon and others he's given. You probably noticed that on your way in. Please feel free to peruse the available selection after the service. Our opening words will be read by Toby Wacker.
Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God.
Thank you, Toby. So now we invite kids and parents up to the front of the room for the children's story, which will be shared today by Rose Smith.
I see some more kids. Oh, well. I'll try to speak loudly. Now, this story is about the first Universalist minister in this country. And in this story, there's a talk about a place called hell. Has anybody ever heard about that word before? Raise your hand if you have.
Yeah.
Well, well, it's a place where bad people go after they die. But you know, we don't believe in hell, so don't worry. Okay, this is a story about a man called John Murray. Over 200 years ago, when the United States of America was still the 13 colonies, there lived a man named John Murray. John Murray and his wife, Eliza, lived in the country of England. They were very religious people. Every Sunday, they got up early, got dressed, ate their breakfast, and went to church. Sometimes John Murray would preach a sermon and talk to the people about God. Now, their church was not a place to be happy. No one smiled. No one smiled, no one laughed, no one sang, because the followers of that religion called Calvinism believed that almost all the people were going to hell. They believed that God would let only a few people into heaven. No matter what people did, even if they were really, really nice and tried really, really hard to be good, they still couldn't go to heaven. No matter what. And so the religion in that church was a very serious business, and the people were expected to be serious too. But one day, John and Eliza Murray heard of a man named Mr. Riley. Mr. Riley was of a different religion, a religion that said people didn't have to go to hell. a religion where people could be happy. Finally, after talking about it for weeks, John and Eliza decided to listen to what Mr. Riley had to say. The next Sunday, they got up early, got dressed, ate their breakfast, and they went to Mr. Riley's church instead of their own. At that church, people smiled. Someone actually laughed. When it came time for the sermon, Mr. Riley got up to preach. He said, "God loves all his children. God doesn't have favorites. Everyone in the universe has the chance to go to heaven and be saved from the fires of hell. Salvation is universal." Mr. Riley was a universalist. And after hearing his sermon, John and Eliza decided they were universalists too. But the people at their old church weren't universalists. "Mr. Murray," they said, very stern, "have you and your wife been going to hear that heretic, Mr. Riley?" "Yes, sirs, we have," answered John Murray. "And do you believe such nonsense, that all people have the chance to be saved?" "Yes, sirs, we do." "Mr. Murray," they said, appalled, "you mustn't say such things." "Yes," said John Murray, "we must." And they said, "Oh, no, you won't." And he said, "Oh, yes, I will." And they said, "Well, you can't stay there. You can't say them here. You and your wife both have to leave." Poor John and Eliza Murray. None of their old friends would talk to them, and they were lonely and sad. Then Eliza had a baby, which made them happy for a while. But then the baby got sick, and Eliza got sick, and John had to borrow money to pay for the doctors. He borrowed more and more money and went to more and more doctors, but they couldn't help. His wife and his baby died. And then he was arrested because he couldn't pay back the money he owed. So there John Murray sat all alone in his cell with no job, no money, no family, and no friends. He decided he had failed God and failed his family and failed himself. He decided he was never going to be part of a church again. He decided he was never going to preach again, ever. After a few days, Eliza's brother paid the money that John owed, and so John was set free. But John wasn't happy in England anymore. He wanted a new life in a new land. He bought a ticket on a sailing ship, hand in hand. The ship had great white sails that were filled by the wind. And the wind blew and blew. The wind blew John Murray all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, far away from England and to a new land. But the wind blew John Murray to a place he hadn't planned to go. He ended up in New Jersey instead of New York. The hand in hand became stranded on a sandbar off the coast. And the sailors couldn't move the ship because the wind kept blowing them into shore. Because there wasn't much food on the ship, John Murray climbed out and waded ashore through a marsh. Near Barnegat Bay, he met a farmer named Thomas Potter, who invited him into his house and gave him supper. Now, Thomas Potter also believed in a loving God, and he believed in universal salvation. He believed in it so much that 10 years before John Murray had showed up on his doorstep blown in by the wind, Thomas Potter had built a little church all by himself. He had been waiting for 10 years and waiting for the right preacher to come. And now the preacher was here. But John Murray didn't want to preach. Not at all. Thomas Potter argued with him and talked to him and prayed over him. And still John Murray didn't want to preach. "I swore I would never preach again," John Murray said, "ever." But Thomas Potter said, "I believe that the wind that brought you here to my door was the breath of God. I believe God sent you here to preach in the church I built. I believe that the wind will never change until you have preached a message from God." "Tell me, sir, if that wind does not change by Sunday morning, will you take that as a sign from God himself that you should preach again?" John Murray thought and thought about that, and finally he said, "I will." The wind blew. The wind blew and blew for days, and it kept the boat from leaving the shore. The wind didn't change. So, on Sunday morning, on the 30th of September, in the year 1770, while that wind was still blowing, John Murray got up early, got dressed, ate his breakfast, and went to church. And he preached. He preached in the church Thomas Potter had built. And he preached of a loving and caring God. He preached of universal salvation, the idea that all people everywhere in the universe could go to heaven and be saved. He said, "You possess only a small light, but uncover it, let it shine." And afterward, when the people came to him and thanked him for his sermon, John Murray changed. He changed his mind about joining a church again, and he changed his mind about being a preacher. In 1779, in the town of Gloucester, Massachusetts, John Murray became the minister of the very first organized Universalist Church in America. He traveled and preached in many places in the United States and became known as one of the founders of American Universalism. The church that Thomas Potter built doesn't exist anymore. It was torn down years ago, but Universalists are still there, Unitarian Universalists now. If you go to a New Jersey, there on the shores of Barnegat Bay, you can stay at a special Unitarian Universalist retreat center named Murray Grove in honor of John Murray, the man who decided to preach again and to let his light shine.
Well, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Reverend Kalen Freestead is an ordained United Methodist minister, and I didn't mention to you that my father was as well. After serving churches in Iowa for 27 years, he embarked upon an independent ministry. He conducted this ministry full-time from 2003 until 2006. It consisted of traveling around the country with his wife, Darlene, accepting invitations to speak at churches and other groups, countering the teaching that many people will suffer eternity in hell, and instead proclaiming the hopeful message of universalism. And Darlene, could you raise your hand so we know where you are? There she is. He went back to the parish ministry in July 2006, and then since as of January 2008, while continuing to serve some churches in Iowa part-time, he resumed his traveling ministry, spending half time on the road speaking on the subject of universalism. And I think the way he does this is he spends a few months at one church, at his churches in Iowa, and then he travels, like maybe he goes to Florida, or maybe he goes to some place like here. So, Reverend Priestad.
It's a great privilege and a pleasure to be with you today. I love UU churches, and I've spoken at somewhere around 90 UU churches around the country. And I don't know what the record is for the most UU churches where anyone has spoken, but I'm working on it. I don't know. Anyway, but UU churches, there's a spirit of welcome and the diversity and respect for each other. And it's just great, and I celebrate that with you. When I served the United Methodist Church in Dallas Center, Iowa, I became acquainted with a UU minister in Des Moines. And when she realized that I believed in universalism, she invited me to attend a special service that they were going to be having. And it was going to be in a small town of Mitchellville, which is just east of Des Moines. And it was to be in a church building that was originally a universalist church. There's not a congregation there at this time. But they had the tradition of having a service there one Sunday each summer as a way of celebrating their universalist heritage. And so I was happy to accept the invitation to join them for that service. And I'll always remember as I walked up the walk in front of that church, over the door it read, Universalist Church. And I thought, I have arrived at home. Universalism has been really important to me for a long time, and as a result, I wrote a book on the subject and spent 3 years traveling full-time speaking, and now half-time. We're in our fourth year of half-time speaking around the country. We had the opportunity to spend 2 months in Florida speaking during this last winter, so that was kind of tough to take, I know. While you all were suffering up here, maybe some of you were in Florida as well, I don't know. But it's been a great joy to travel around speaking on the subject of universalism. Today I'd like to speak on the subject on the history and the significance of the teaching of universalism. It is sometimes referred to as universal salvation, so I'd like to offer a definition of salvation that's probably different from what you've heard from other sources. You're probably aware that at least among conservative Christians, the definition of salvation would be to accept Jesus as your personal savior so you can go to heaven when you die. Well, I believe that's not a very adequate understanding of salvation. And so a definition that works for me is salvation is to learn and grow either with or without divine influence so as to experience fullness of life in this life and beyond. And if you don't believe in the divine, or if you don't believe in life after death, you can just leave those parts off the definition. So salvation to me is to learn and grow so as to experience fullness of life. That I think it to me, that's the most basic understanding of salvation. And so in contrast to what many people believe, I reject the idea that a lot of people will spend eternity suffering in hell. Instead, I believe that everyone will eventually experience salvation or fullness of life. And whether that takes place in this life or sometime after this life, I don't know. But I'm confident everyone will eventually experience salvation or fullness of life. During the time of the early church, it was commonly taught in the religions of the day that most people would spend eternity suffering in hell. There was at least one exception, and they were the Zoroastrians. They were universalists, and that's a wonderful thing. But also Jesus, in contrast to his Jewish upbringing, did not teach that a lot of people would spend eternity suffering in hell. Instead, it's clear from many passages in the Bible that Jesus taught that everyone would eventually experience fullness of life. In the environment, though, where it was commonly believed that the majority of people, probably the vast majority, would spend eternity suffering in hell, it was hard to convince a lot of people otherwise. And so there were many people, or at least a good number of people, who were converted to Christianity, but they weren't fully converted. They continued to hang on to their belief of endless suffering of many people beyond death. But there were a lot of people who were fully converted. And it may have been the majority, or maybe even the vast majority, of the early Christians were universalists. There was Clement and Origen of Alexandria, and they did I say that right? Alexandria. I serve a church in Alexander, Iowa. This is Alexandria in Egypt. Anyway, they were Clement and Origen were strong leaders and theologians during the time of the early church. And there were others, including Gregory of Nyssa, Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, and Jerome, who translated the Bible into Latin, which is known as the Vulgate. And there were women, strong women leaders in the Universalist movement among the early Christians. There was Macrina the Younger and Macrina the Elder. I guess they weren't very imaginative with their names. But anyway, they are considered, they were strong participants in terms of spreading the message of universalism, and they are considered saints in the Roman Catholic Church today. Isn't that cool? As I said, though, there were some people who weren't fully converted. Tertullian was one example of that. He became a Christian at age 40, and he continued to believe that that many people would suffer forever in hell. In fact, he so relished the idea of people suffering in hell that he said he believed that one of the best things about heaven would be the superb view of the damned frying in hell. Doesn't the thought of that just make you feel good all over? Isn't that awful? Somebody who professed to be a follower of Jesus, a follower of the one who taught so much about love and compassion and mercy and grace and forgiveness, could so relish the idea of so many people suffering excruciating torment forever. Well, the theologian Augustine was another person who wasn't fully converted. He became a Christian at age 32, and he held on to his belief of endless suffering of many people beyond death. But Augustine lived in the latter part of the 4th century and into the 5th century. But he was a pretty decent theologian in many respects, and so it's not surprising that his theology started to become dominant in the church at that time. Well, by the 6th century, because his theology becoming increasingly more prevalent and dominant in the church, that generated division and controversy over the issue of universalism. Well, in order to resolve this controversy, the Roman Emperor Justinian called a church council. It was the 5th ecumenical council in the year 553. Now, does it seem a little strange to you that a Roman emperor would call a church meeting? Well, it makes perfect sense when you think about the fact that emperors like to control people, right? That's a given. Emperors like to control people. And the people back then had learned that threatening people with eternal damnation is a foolproof means of controlling them. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? People do that yet today because it works. It's a way to keep your congregants in line, threaten them with eternal hell if they don't do what you say, right? And so that's what they did back then. But the problem is the emperor and the hellraisers of the day, the advocates of unending suffering of many people in hell, they were having trouble controlling those free-spirited universalists. They could threaten them with unending hell all they wanted, and they didn't take it seriously. And so out of frustration, the emperor allied himself with the advocates of the teaching of unending hell. And together they pushed through a resolution which abolished the teaching of universalism. Well, it's not surprising that with the power of the church as well as the state against the teaching of universalism pretty well died out after that and went underground or dormant. And that continued for about 1,000 years. But you can't suppress the truth indefinitely, right? Eventually it'll start bubbling up someplace. And that's what happened about 300 years ago. It really started before 300 years ago, but about 300 years ago, it started to become a strong movement again. John Wesley, who was the primary founder of the Methodist movement and leader of the Methodist movement back in the 18th century, he had a close association with a group of Christians called the Moravians. Now, the Moravians were universalists, but Wesley used to argue with them. He thought they were really wrong. But he continued his lifelong association with the Moravians, and it seems that they eventually wore him down because he too came to believe in universalism. Now, I love to tell United Methodists that Wesley came to believe in universalism late in his life. And that is because in the United Methodist Church, the most conservative people in the church are the ones who are the most likely to reject the teaching of universalism. At the same time, they can often be heard to say, let's go back and reestablish the teachings of John Wesley. And I say, yeah, let's do that. Because he came to believe in universalism later in his life. The American colonies proved to be a particularly fertile ground for the spread of the teaching of universalism. George de Benneville came over from France in 1741, and he spread the teaching through a good part of Pennsylvania, although I don't think he necessarily started in any churches or anything like that, but he spread the message of universalism. But then John Murray came over in 1770, and we had the wonderful message, the story of his arrival. And I had the privilege a couple, 3 years ago, of preaching at the church that he served and he founded in Gloucester, Massachusetts. That's wonderful. It's Gloucester, I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but it's a wonderful place right on the shore. And it's very, very pretty. And the church is magnificent. You ought to go sometime if you have a chance. Anyway, John Murray worked closely with the Quakers and the Baptists in spreading the teaching of universalism throughout the American colonies. Now, it might seem a little strange that he worked closely with the Baptists. You can understand that he would work closely with the Quakers because a lot of Quakers yet today are quite receptive to the teaching of universalism. But unfortunately, the Baptists are a little different situation, at least among the Southern Baptists. But the American Baptists, they're real receptive to the teaching of universalism, I've found. And there's a growing number of Southern Baptists who are starting to see the light. And that's because they've been taught all their lives, right? Taught all their lives that God is love. And they're starting to think, okay, now, does that really square with the idea of God sending people to hell forever? Or if people end up there of their own free will, just abandoning them forever? That doesn't make sense. And so it's still a small percent. But it's a significant group of people who are starting to become universalists from among fundamentalist churches. Anyway, Murray worked closely with the Quakers and the Baptists, spreading the teaching of universalism, and it was under his leadership that the Universalist Church in America was organized. As in the early church, there were women involved in the movement, strong leaders, including Hannah Whitehall Smith and Olympia Brown, who was the first woman to be ordained in any major denomination, which was in 1863. And I'm scheduled to speak at the church that's named that where she served in Racine. I'm going to be speaking there later this summer. And the church is named after her, and she served it for 10 years or more, I think. Anyway, so it's a wonderful thing. Jose Ballou was the most prominent leader in the Universalist Church during his life and ministry. And when he died in 1852, the Universalist Church had about 800,000 members. So it was a strong movement, to be sure. The teaching of Universalism hasn't been promoted only by Universalists or Unitarians, for that matter, but has been promoted by leaders and theologians from other denominations as well. For example, back in the 19th century, there was a German theologian named Friedrich Schleiermacher. I wonder, how many here have heard of old Friedrich? Okay, one person I see, or two maybe. That's about average, I'd say. Not too many people have heard of old Friedrich, but he was a fine theologian, a strong advocate of universalism. Besides that, I just like to say his name. Friedrich Schleiermacher. Isn't that a wonderful name? I just think it's grand. In the 20th century, there were other leaders who taught that everyone would eventually experience fullness of life. Karl Barth, Paul Tillich, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Leslie Weatherhead, and others. So the teaching of universalism has a long, rich history. For more than 500 years following the time of Jesus, and then especially again in the last 300 years. So you might wonder, why is this so important to me as a United Methodist minister? Unfortunately, that's really not our doctrine or our official beliefs in the church to believe in universalism. But I find a lot of United Methodists who do believe it. There's a lot of closet universalists in the United Methodist Church. You know, they believe it. When you talk to them individually, they'll usually admit it. But they don't often openly admit it because they're afraid other people will criticize them or not like them or something. But anyway, this is very important to me because it seems to me that the teaching of a God of eternal damnation has prevailed for far too long in most churches and in our society at large, and with devastating consequences. One of the consequences, and one of the reasons this is so important to me, is the teaching of a God of eternal damnation turns many people away from God. People know that they would never ever punish their own children without end, and so they just can't relate to a God who people say does that very same thing. So the teaching of a God of eternal damnation turns many people away from God. Sometimes they become atheists. Now, I need to acknowledge that I've learned a lot about atheism from UUs. And I'm grateful. When we went on the road, I thought I knew something about atheism, and of course I did know a little, but not very much. I met a lot of wonderful atheists in UU churches around the country. It's just been a great joy of my life, quite frankly. I've met a lot of people, wonderful people of a variety of faiths in UU churches, of course. But I've learned from the atheists that for many of them, they find it to be a thoughtful, responsible, mature way to approach life, and it works for them. And so for people for whom atheism works, I don't have any difficulty at all with that. But in other denominations, it's not always such a positive thing when a person becomes an atheist. That's because they still have in the back of the mind the possibility of spending eternity in hell, and if there's no God to rescue them from that plight, then they conclude that they are doomed, and that leads to despair and meaninglessness. In a lot of churches, people go to church only at Christmas and Easter. That wouldn't happen in a UU church for the reasons I'm going to mention. You might have other reasons. I don't always attend. But anyway, people attend at Christmas and Easter because those are two times of celebration. And on those two times, there's no danger anybody's going to bring up that awful teaching of a God of eternal damnation. They've heard more damnation teaching than they care to hear about, and they don't want to hear any more. And so it's out of self-preservation and respect for their own integrity, I guess. They just stay away from church, except for those two times of celebration, when there's little danger anybody's going to bring up eternal damnation. And then there's perhaps half the population that doesn't go to church at all, not even at Christmas and Easter. And I've spoken to a lot of unchurched people, and they so often bring up the idea of people spending eternity in hell, that it obviously is an issue that weighs heavily upon them. And it seems that somebody will agree with him to tell him that it ain't so, that God's not a monster who throws people into hell kicking and screaming against their will to punish them forever because they were naughty. Or God is not a weak and stupid and powerless God who just allows people to go floundering around through life and somehow of their own free will end up in hell and then just abandon them there. What kind of a God is that? Who in their right mind would want to serve a monster God who throws people into hell to torture them because they were naughty? Or who couldn't care less if people end up in hell of their own free will and just abandon them there? What loving parent would do that with their own children? So many people are not aware that there are progressive and open-minded United Methodist and Presbyterian and Lutheran and Episcopal and United Church of Christ and that sort of thing, as well as UU churches. And they're not aware that there are churches that teach love instead of judgment, that teach hope instead of damnation, and so they drop out of church altogether. We all want to make the world a better place, but it seems to me that we're not going to have much success in doing this as long as the teaching of a God of eternal damnation continues to prevail in most churches and in our society at large. And that is because people's perception of God has a powerful and direct influence on how they live their lives. If people believe that God is judgmental and condemning and cruel, it's very easy to justify living that same way themselves. It's like the old song, One Tin Soldier, goes, "Go ahead and hate your neighbor. Go ahead and cheat a friend. Do it in the name of heaven. You can justify it in the end." Sadly, I see people in our own country and around the world every day seeking to justify evil behavior in the name of heaven, in the name of God, and it's much easier to do that if we believe that God is judgmental and condemning and cruel. On the other hand, if we believe that God is loving and kind and merciful and gracious and patient and so on, then we're much more likely to reflect that in our lives as well. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was sometimes criticized because he loved his enemies too much. He was told, "You shouldn't love your enemies, you should seek to destroy them." To which he replied, "Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" Isn't that powerful? Do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? Abraham Lincoln was a universalist. He rejected the teaching of a God of eternal damnation. He believed in the power of love and the preciousness of each individual and that everyone would eventually experience fullness of life. And so, as a result, he could love even his enemies. And what a difference that made in how he lived his life. I believe we who are universalists, who believe in the preciousness of each individual and the power of love, we have, I believe we are called to live the same way that Abraham Lincoln did. And as a result, we can rise above being judgmental and cruel and transform the world through love. So we who believe in universalism, who believe in the preciousness of each individual, and who believe in the power of love, have a wonderful message to share with the world, and it's powerfully important that we do so. There's a man named Robert Short who wrote a book called Something to Believe In, a wonderful book on universalism. And in it, he says, there is too much at stake for us to allow ourselves to be intimidated by the wrathful self-righteousness of the hell-raising gloomy doomies. Isn't that some mouthful? There is too much at stake for us to allow ourselves to be intimidated by the wrathful self-righteousness of the hell-raising gloomy doomies. And then he goes on to say, therefore, our witness to them should be just as aggressive and unambiguous as theirs has been to us. Fundamentalists can be intimidating, can't they? They go around quoting the Bible and asking people whether or not they're saved. They can be intimidating, but I say let's not be intimidated by them. After all, we are the ones with the good news to share with the world. They, in contrast, spread a message that is divisive and leads to cruel and inhumane behavior and justifies abuse. What the perception of the fundamentalists, it really isn't that big of a deal to go to war to kill people of other faiths or people who don't have a particular faith, because they believe that those people are all going to hell anyway, and so they're really not as valuable as if they were so-called evangelical Christians. And so you can kill them without feeling nearly as guilty as if they were Christians. Also, with that, with the perception of the fundamentalists, it is really no big deal to torture people, whether that's at Guantanamo Bay or wherever. After all, they contend that God fashioned hell specifically for the purpose of torturing naughty people forever. And if it's okay for God to torture people, it surely must be okay for us to do it. Besides that, the torture that we might inflict upon people, whether that's waterboarding or whatever, is nothing compared to the torture that they say that God is going to inflict upon people forever in a lake of fire, no less. So we who believe in universalism, who believe in the preciousness of each individual, who believe in the power of love, have a wonderful message to share with the world. So it's important that we not be intimidated by the hellraisers. The teaching of a God of eternal damnation leads to wars and racism and oppression and abuse, while the spread of the teaching of universalism leads to equality, respect, love, and dignity for all. So I say, let's not be intimidated by the hellraisers. Instead, let us freely and boldly proclaim to the world the wonderful message of universalism, and the world will be infinitely better off because of it. Amen.
Well, we have about, we have discussions, yep. So we have about 5 minutes or so, and Nick will bring the mic around.
One of the things I've learned about UUs or from UUs is that they tend to not be very pushy when it comes to spreading good news to other people. And part of it is in reaction to so-called evangelicals or fundamentalists who can be really pushy in regard to sharing their faith. I encourage you to somehow get beyond that, if you can, to realize that you truly have good news to share with the world and your neighbors. And there's no reason for you to be intimidated. And there will be opportunities. They know you're a member of the UU Church, and they think you're all going to hell because you're misguided, right? I mean, isn't that a common understanding? At least I know some people believe that. And because you don't believe as they do, and so on. But anyway, it's typical for the subject to come up among neighbors, among coworkers, and sometimes in family. But I know you have to be diplomatic, and you don't want to run all your friends off. So, but I just encourage you to realize that you really do have good news to share. It's a message of love, the power of love. And of course, you're loving people, and you'll try to share that gently and kindly, but I think it's really important to do that. That's a good point, because labels tend to divide, unfortunately. At the same time, labels can instruct to help us sort of give us some identity or whatever, but yes, please. Yes, I spoke at a church in Riverside, California, where the minister said they really don't talk about heaven or hell or universalism, they just sort of assume everybody believes it. The minister believed it, and she assumed that everybody else did. But she was hesitant first to even invite me, thinking, well, we don't even need to hear what you have to say, because we all believe in universalism. Well, I preached it, and boy, there was a great outpouring of gratitude. They said, no one's ever said anything like that in this church before. I never heard of such a thing before. And so while the minister assumed people believed it, a lot of the people had never even heard of the concept of universalism. And that's consistent with what you're saying. Yeah, we need to not assume, we need to keep spreading the good news, I think. There are many concepts or terms. Gehenna, that is an example. Anyway, so there are some words that are translated hell in some translations, but not others. So it's not a clear thing. You know, I mean, there really aren't a lot of references, quite frankly, to hell. And then the ones that there are, in many cases, there's no indication that it's without end. And you know, a temporary hell, sort of like the Catholic purgatory concept. You know, where you go there for a while and you sort of, you know, you get sort of straightened out, and then you can go into heaven. And you're right. The Bible doesn't teach hell nearly as clearly as you get it preached from a lot of pulpits, unfortunately.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you and join us for coffee and conversation. Thank you.
Welcome, my pleasure.
Let me hand over a check. It's a good service, I think.